We're holding on page Mem in Ksubus, or Islamic days. We started learning yesterday about the sickness called Rason. We said that the person has some kind of insect in his brain. The Gemara had described the whole method of brain surgery to get it out. But meanwhile, as long as it's in there, we said that he has various physical symptoms. His eyes are constantly, his eyes and his nose and his mouth are constantly running, and flies are always following him. And we mentioned that Rasan is a type of shin, which would also mean that there's some kind of skin disease involved as well. So the Gemara continues on this topic. Rabbi Yochanan would announce, be careful, don't get anywhere near the flies that hang around a Baal Rasan, because they carry the germs of the disease. Reb Zera wouldn't even sit downwind of a person who has Rasan, in other words, in the direct, so that he wouldn't even want that the breeze, that the wind should blow from the Baal Rasan to him, because again, it might carry some of the germs to him. Apparently, by the way, the idea seems to be, I guess, I mean, the actual Rasan itself, we said, is a bug in his brain. Preposterous. It's a little hard to see how that would be carried by the flies. Maybe they could carry eggs. The wind, it's a little harder to see. Maybe fart, it could. Maybe it could hatch eggs or something that are small enough to carry in the wind. Or maybe the Gemara just means that it would cause a person to develop similar symptoms, not necessarily the actual full-blown rasam. Whatever the case, these chachamim would be careful of such things. Rabbi Elazar wouldn't even go under the same roof as a Baal Rasan. Marsha points out that means, in effect, he's considering him like a Metzora. A Metzora is a mess. A Metzora is compared to a mess. And there is, in fact, a din that both a mess, we know, if you're under the same roof as a mess, then it causes tumor, and a Metzora has a somewhat similar din. So here, Rabbi Elazar would treat a Baal Rasan the same way and would avoid him. I mentioned yesterday a vote from the Kli Yoker who says that the Baal Rasan over here represents a Baal Lashon Hara, and that's why in particular he said flies are attracted to him, because flies are always attracted to filth and sores and things like that, and the same way Baal Lashon Hara is always somebody who looks out for the bad about people. So that also explains, he says, these various chachamim that are saying stay away from such people. It doesn't just mean the physical disease of Rasan, it also means the ruchnistika disease behind it of being a Baal Lashon Hara. So these various chachamim are saying you have to keep your utmost distance from such people. Rab Ami and Rab Asi would go even further. They wouldn't even eat eggs that came from the same mavui where a Baal Rasan lived. A mavui, we know from particularly from the Sefta Erevin, is a side street. It could be either a mavri sosum, which is a dead end street, or a mavri mafulosh, which is a through street. Either way, you'd have people would live in houses that open out into chatseiras that in turn open out into the mavri. So the mavri itself is quite some distance from the guy's house. You have a chatser in between them, and you have various other chatseiras surrounding the mavri. Nevertheless, Rav Ami and Rav Asi went to the extent of not even eating eggs that came from any of the households in a mavri where one of the houses was occupied by Baal Rasan. And the point is, before Hashem say also, even though eggs, out of all foods, they come with their own, not all foods, but whatever, out of many foods, they come with their own natural covering, a shell, and still Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi are concerned about the germs. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, michrach bahu v'osik b'torah. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi would join together. Michrach literally means wrap. So maybe attacker means he would give them a hug, I don't know, but whatever the case, it means he would stay very close to them and he would learn Torah. Rashi explains it means when he's learning Torah, he would have Baalei Rason sit next to him, trusting that the chus of the Torah will protect him. The Ritva learns a little differently over here. He says it wasn't even necessarily when he's learning Torah. Once the Gemara in Sota tells us that Torah has the ability to protect a person even when he's not actually learning it right now. So therefore, he was relying on that schus to protect him from catching this disease even when he's not actually learning it right now, learns the Ritva. Omar, he said, after all, the Pasuk says, Ayelas Ahovim V'yalas Chein. The Torah is described as a lovely ayelas, a gazelle or whatever, the yalaschein and a graceful mountain goat. Just different expressions in the pasuk referring to the beauty and the grace that learning Torah gives to a person. So he figured imchein mala alamdeha. If the Torah brings grace to those who learn it, aguni le magni, wouldn't it also protect? So just that, in other words, so it'll protect me. So again, according to Rashi, Dafka when he's learning, according to the Ritva, and Marsha says much the same, that it means even when he's not learning. Maram Shif, in fact, adds a point. You think of it, you look at a Baal Ras and he looks pretty disgusting. There's no chain to him at all between the dripping eyes and nose and mouth and the sores and the flies and all that. Even before we said the various Amiroyim would stay away from him, push it, so they don't catch it. But besides that, he's very repulsive just in his looks. Nevertheless, Rabbi Shimon Levi figured, if the Torah gives grace to a person, then it means that it'll save me from ever becoming like that, from ever developing such a disease.
They're also learning Torah.
Well, so now they're learning Torah. Maybe a tracker will help them. In fact, the Kli Yoker goes on in that explanation. He says this is all support of what Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is thinking. Like this, the other Chachamim are saying stay away as far as possible from the Baal Lashon Hara. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, on the other hand, is taking the view, you know what, Fakir, learn Torah with such a person, maybe it'll have an effect on him, maybe it'll actually cure him Beruchnius and Begashnius. Well, the Gemara tells, Ki have a shochiv, when it was Rabbi Shurban Levi's time to pass away, so they told, the based in Shamayla, told the Malach HaMavis, go do whatever he wants. So you're tasked with taking his neshama, as it usually is, but first go do whatever he wants. We'll tell the whole story, and then we'll talk about some fascinating ideas that the Maharal says to explain the deeper meaning of what's going on over here. Anyway, Ozilus Chazile, so the Malach HaMavis came and appeared to Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Omalei, so Rabbi Yehoshua says, Achli liduchtoi, show me my place. Show me, in other words, I want to see the place where I'm going to be in Gan Eden. Marsha says, again, let's just talk about the surface meaning of the story. Afterwards, we'll talk about what the Maharal says about a deeper level of the story. But Marsha says that the point is, this way, he shouldn't feel tsar when he's about to pass away. He should realize the tremendous place that he's going to have in Gan Eden. So he wants the Malach HaMavis to show it to him. Omalei Lachaya, so the Malach HaMavis says, sure. Omalei, yeah, so they're walking along over there. Omalei, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says to the Malach HaMavis, Havli Sakincha, give me your knife. Dilma Mivasas Li Be'urcha, because otherwise you might frighten me with it, you might scare me with it on the way. I'm going to see you walking along with your knife, which is the Gemara mentions elsewhere. We're going to learn in Nedarim in a few weeks, Be'ez Hashem, that the Malach HaMavis has, so to speak, a sword, that the poison drips from it, drops of poison drips from it, and that's what causes a person to die. So therefore, so in the metaphor over here in the story, we're saying that Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying, I don't want you to be threatening me with the knife while we're walking. Okay, so the Malach HaMavis gives the knife to him. Ki motel hosam, when he came to there, Dalye, then the Malach HaMavis lifted him up. We have to picture Gan Eden as being like a walled garden. So it's like there's a high wall around it, so therefore the Malach HaMavis had to boost Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi up to see over the wall. Marsha points out, now we usually think of Gan Eden as being a whole different world, but there is in fact a Gemara in Talmud that implies that Olam Hazeh, that Gan Eden is someplace in Olam Hazeh. So therefore, it's possible for him to physically walk there. Ben Yoyada points out, actually, you know, we talk about this Gan Eden Atachten and Gan Eden Elyon. Even Gan Eden Atachten, he says, really, I mean, it's in our world, but it's not like, you know, by now they've satellite mapped the entire world. They've never found any Gan Eden on Earth. So what it is what? Well, you have to ask, then where is it hiding out? Befrat, the Gemara mentions elsewhere that Gan Eden is actually larger than the world. So the answer is, in other words, it's part of the Gashmiistic world, but it's not part of it at the same time, meaning, in other words, it's a higher level of Gashmius. Somewhat similar to, you know, when we talk about Yaakov Avinu Lo Meis, for example, you have, and we're going to talk about soon, about Rebbe and that connection. You have levels of Gashmius, that you have levels within Gashmius itself, levels that are visible and accessible to our eyes and to our scientific instruments, and then you have ones which are still part of Gashmius, but outside of our ken. So Gan Eden Atachten is an example of that, and Gan Eden Elyon is something beyond that altogether. So he picked him up. Komach Vilei, and the Malach HaMavis is showing him there is your place in Gan Eden. Shavo Nafalahu Gisa. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi took his opportunity. Shavo, he jumped Nafalahu Gisa, and he fell on the other side of the wall. So now he's inside Gan Eden alive. He's one of the few people who are mentioned in the Medrash someplace that lists a number of people who went in Gan Eden alive. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is one of those few. Nakte counted the glume. The Malach HaMavis was still grabbing onto a corner of Rabbi Shurban Levi's garment. And Rabbi Shurban Levi says, "Bishvua sadolay asina. I swear with a shvua that I'm not coming back." So at this point, Hashem gets involved. Hashem says, well, let's see. If Rabbi Shurban Levi throughout his life ever was matu neder, or shvuah, strictly speaking. We talked yesterday about a Torah Nedarim, a Torah Shavuos. There can be, throughout his life, he may have made a shvuah. Did he ever go to be matu that shvuah? Or did he just go and fulfill it? If he ever did nehadar, then he's going to have to return. Because, yes, he swore now that he's going to stay in Gan Eden and not return. But, okay, if there's been times in his life where he was matir a shvua, then let him be matir it now also, and he's going to have to leave Gan Eden. Eloi, loy nehadar, and if not, then he doesn't have to return. Well, now he never had to revoke a shvua of his before, therefore we're not going to do that now. Marsha points out, obviously, there's no question of making him be over on his shavua. The question is making him be matir it. But if he never did that during his lifetime, then Hashem is saying, we're not going to make him do that now. A couple of them, Farshim over here, deal with various angles on what's the connection. I mean, okay, it so happens that he swore, but what's the connection that Hashem is saying that if he never had a shavua revoked, then he should be able to stay in Gan Eden. So Ian Yaakov brings a pilpul on it based on some psukim regarding Ataras Nadarim and other related things. Anaf Yosef discusses a point that Moshe Rabbeinu also wanted to not die through the Malach HaMavis. So now the question is Rabbi Shurban Levi going to say that he's greater than Moshe Rabbeinu, that he's going to Gan Eden alive and Moshe didn't? So it'll depend. If he was ever Matir Shvua, then in effect what he's saying is that person who was Matir is greater than him. Because out you have to go to somebody greater than you to be Matir Shavua. Well, in that case, you're not on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, then you certainly can't override what Moshe did and go into Gan Eden alive. On the other hand, if you never did, then you have the right to be considered to a certain extent on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore you can stay. No, but the point, each one has their individual reason for being there, but the point is, at least the other ones, we don't find that they had to trick, trick the Malach HaMavis into going in there. Each of them has their own reason. Agav, by the way, one of them has to do with this week's parasha. It says that Baspare is one of those select few who went into Gan Eden alive as a schus for having raised Moshe. But Bepashrus, when she passed away, normally Bepashrus the Malach HaMavis, and instead of the Malach HaMavis taking her, the Eibishter just said you have the ability to go into Gan Eden alive. Here we're saying Rabbi Shurban Levi kind of had to, so to speak, trick the Malach HaMavis into it. Serach, I think, is one of them. Well, yes, Serach is one of them. Also, the Medrash gives. I think it's an Ovid Sudam Nasan gives a list of them. Yeah. One interesting one on the list, by the way, it mentions Chirom Melech Tzur, who was in Gan Eden alive, and then he was thrown out of it. Because he went into Gan Eden alive, but the Psukim and Sefer Yechezkel describe how eventually he started thinking of himself as a god. He had lived so long, he had lived already since the time of David and Shlomo 500 years earlier. There's an opinion in the Medrash, even that he's identical with Chira, the friend of Yehuda and Parshas Vayeshev, and in that case he'd be 1,200 years old by that time, and he even went into Gan Eden alive, b'chola b'chola, and as the Gemara in Chulin tells us, that's unfortunately how it is a lot of times with the Goyim. The Eibishter gives them greatness and it goes to their head, and they start thinking of themselves as greater than they are. So apparently that happened to him in Gan Eden, and apparently he started thinking that way even while he was in Gan Eden, and therefore he got thrown out of there, and eventually he was killed and then destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. This is Chiram Melech Tzur. Elio went up to Shemayim alive in a chariot over there. I don't think he's actually in the list. Where did he go? I mean, he keeps on coming back down to earth, right? But I don't know. I don't think he's not on that list. I don't believe he's on that list in Ovis Sidam Nustin of those who went into Gan Eden alive, but I could be wrong about that. I don't know. So getting back to the story, Omale, so now the Malach HaMavis says, Havli Sakinoya, right, at least give me back my knife. Lo Havi Yoivle, Rabbi Shurban Levi didn't want to give it to him. What, you should be able to use it in the future on other people. Nafka Baskola v'Omrele, so Basko came out and said to Rabbi Shurban Levi, Havni Ale, at least give him back the knife. Dimitbo Labiyosa. The fact is, it is needed for other people. Fine, you yourself managed to evade the Malach HaMavis and his knife, but the fact is, Misa is a necessary thing for the world. Most people have to go through it, and therefore you have to give him back his knife. So fine. At this point in the story, let's talk a little bit about what the Maharal says about this. He says like this, most tzaddikim, when they're in a goof, they're not there's still a certain separation between them and the Eibishter. You know, like you have the story in Kovitz Mechtov in the back of Tillim, where the Mizrach Magid eventually realizes after a vision of Gan Eden that he had, that Gam Guf Kodesh Bosahu, that even the holiest body of a tzaddik is still after all flesh, and it still makes a certain separation between a tzaddik and the Eibishter. So therefore, what it is for most tzaddikim, therefore they have to go through the Malach HaMavis separates their neshama from their body, and then they're able to go and be united with the Eibishter. Rabbi Shurban Levi is one of those rare tzaddikim, he says, who was not like that. He's on the level beyond that. He's one with the Eibishter even in his lifetime. Al Derech, the Gemara is going to compare him in a minute to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who also, you have the expression that he says on himself in Zoyar, B'chad k'tira es katana, I'm bound with one bond to the Eibishter. So therefore, so Fakir, the Malach HaMavis is not going to come take his neshama. Fakir, the based in Shamayla, is telling the Malach HaMavis, do whatever he wants, meaning you're going to be the means by which he's going to get to his higher level rather than the way it is by most people. So therefore, so again, he takes him to Gan Eden. And what he's saying is also, so he's saying, I want to see my place, in other words, I want to have the menuchas nefesh. I want to know what I actually accomplished during my lifetime and what that means in terms of my place in Gan Eden. By the way, Marsha points out the word duchtoi is actually, we'll talk about what Maharsha says in a minute when we get further on to the Gemara. Anyway, so he goes on to say that the rest of the story also represents all this concept. The Malach HaMavis is still grabbing on to a corner. So the Shurban Levi makes it into Gan Eden. He jumps over and falls down the other side, meaning that now he's in Gan Eden. He actually made it there. But on the other hand, in Gan Eden itself, you don't go any greater than you were before. So in that sense, it can be called falling. Like he fell in there, so to speak. But then the Malach HaMavis is still holding on to a corner of him, representing, you still have a certain connection with Gashmias. And at that point, he says, I swear, which is an oath is in Hashem's name, that I'm not getting out of here, meaning he's saying, I'm joining Hashem into this whole business over here. So now we have to see, well, was he ever Matir Shvua? Then it means that his connection with Hashem is not 100%. But if he never was, if he always, whenever he made a shvur, he always fulfilled it, then it shows that now when he's making a shvur, means that he's demonstrating with that he has 100% connection with the Eibishter, and therefore the Malach HaMavis has no further power over him, and he gets to stay there. I've heard of that also. I don't know. I'm not up there in the Ulam Asoyonim to know exactly what the Rebbe is doing over there. And I know what you're talking about. Yeah, there's a famous story that Rebbe told about, I think, a Berditchever said that he swears that he's not going to go into Gan Eden until Mashiach comes, and then they beguiled him and tricked him to going in there, and there was some later tzaddik who did the same thing, and the Rebbe said something similar about himself. Yeah, more than that, I don't know. What? I'm doing a b'tzibur. I'm making a shvur b'tzibur? Okay, yeah. Okay, I don't remember exactly. I know what you're talking about, but I don't remember the product. Strictly speaking, like we talked about yesterday, a neder is on a thing, a shvur is on the person. So if he's saying I will do or I won't do such and such, strictly speaking, that's a shvur, not a neder. Here also, the Shurban Levi says I'm not going out of here. That would be a shvur. To hold on to Rabbi Shurban Levi's garment. That's essentially what the Maharal was making a point. And it's a very deep point. It's a little hard to follow in Chiddush HaGodes, but he makes a point over there that, in other words, Rabbi Shurban Levi, even there in Gan Eden, has a shtickle shaychus still to the world, and that can be represented by the Malach HaMavis grabbing a hold of the corner of his. What?
And get rid of him.
Eventually you can, which is how he did. Okay, but nevertheless, even in Gan Eden, first of all, there's different levels in Gan Eden itself. But second of all, wait a minute. So the Gemara continues. Machriz Eliyahu Kameh. Eliyahu was going in front of Rabbi Shurban Levi and announcing, Panu Mokum Levar Levoi, Panu Mokum Levar Levoi. Clear space for Bar Levoi, for the son of Levi. Clear space for the son of Levi. Marsha points out, first of all, the implication is apparently some other tzaddikim were using that space, and now it has to be cleared for him. On the other hand, Ben Yehoyada says maybe not. It means like clear space where now he can have like a huge crowd in front of him where he can teach them Torah. Marsha also adds that the double expression, panu mokum v'alivoy, panu mokum v'alivoy, represents a point that we learned in Chagiga a couple of months ago. Every yid has, to begin with, as it starts out with a space in Gan Eden and a space in Gehenim. A tzaddik doesn't need a space in Gehenim anymore. So instead, a Rosha doesn't need a space in Gan Eden. He's forfeited it. So therefore, the tzaddik winds up getting two spaces, his own and the one of a rasha who forfeited it. And vice versa, the rasha ends up getting two spaces in Gehenim. So to represent that is why they use this double expression, why Yo is repeating the expression, panu mokin. He went in Gan Eden and he met up with Reb Shimon Yochai. Da'aba Yosef al tlas asa tafteke pizah. He saw Reb Shimon Yochai was sitting on 13 stools or couches or whatever made out of gold. Paz pizah in Aramaic is a very high quality of gold. Tafteke actually translates it with a French word that means basically a folding chair. It's a word for some kind of chair. Yeah, that's exactly what we're saying. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, no, we're talking about after he came in. No, we're saying when he first jumped over the wall, the Malachim Avos had a hand. After that, he's already in, and the Malachim Avos is out of the picture. Yeah. The French word Rashi uses, by the way, it started out meaning a folding chair. As it developed later on in modern French, it actually means something like an armchair or a sofa or something. So whatever, it's some kind of 13 of such chairs that are appropriate for Reb Shimon Yochai. Omalei, so he asked him, Antu Barlevoi? Are you Barlevoi? Are you the one they've been making this whole to-do, this whole announcement about? Omalei Hein, he says yes. Omalei, said Reb Shimon, asked him, Nirasa Akeshus B'yamecha, was a rainbow ever seen in your times? Omalei Hein, and Reb Shimon Levi says yes. So Reb Shimon says, Im Kein I'ata Barlevoi. Well, if a rainbow was ever seen during your lifetime, then you can't be Barlevoi, because you don't deserve, Rashi says, you don't deserve such an announcement. That kind of announcement would be, I mean, what's the purpose of a rainbow? Is the Eibush to promise after the Mabul that he's never going to bring a Mabul, no matter how bad the world gets? In the times of great tzaddikim, such as Reb Shimon himself, a rainbow never needed to appear because he protected the whole world with his schus. So Reb Shimon is saying to Reb Shimon Levi, if there was a rainbow ever visible during your lifetime, then it means that you're not on the level that they should have been making such an announcement about you. And the Gemara points out Veloihi. Now, it's actually not so. Veloi havoi midi. There was actually, the Taka never was a rainbow in Rabbi Shor ben Levi's lifetime. Elasava, but he figured to himself, la'achsik tivusel nafshoi. It's not right that I should be taking credit for myself and talking about that I'm so great that a rainbow never appeared in my times. Ben Yehoyada says he might have, I mean, after all, he can't say something untrue either. So maybe, for example, he could say that it appeared when he was a child. When he's a child, when he's not the great tzaddik, Rabbi Shimon Levi yet, then yeah, his chosim are not yet protecting the world, so then a rainbow might well have appeared. So then it's not, strictly speaking, untrue, but yeah. So that's the end of the story. So that's what happened with Rabbi Shimon Levi. The Maharal finishes off over there and says that this was kind of Rabbi Shimon Levi's last test. So you ask me, how does the Malach HaMavis have any place in Gan Eden? Well, you see that there's room for tests in Gan Eden as well. So he's being tested. What's he going to answer to that? And Itaki gave the correct answer. Okay, listen, I mean, all of this is ultimately talking about Olam HaSel Yonim far beyond us, but at least we can try to understand it to some extent on in our Megushim Dika level, yeah. So he stayed in Gan Eden. Yeah, he's like I said, he's one of the people who went into Gan Eden alive and stayed that way. This means he's important because, in other words, his father, that generally when you find by Nevi'im, for example, it says that whenever he's mentioned with his father's name, it means his father was a Navi as well. Similarly, I think in general, we say when a Tana or an Amora is mentioned with his father's name, it means his father was also an Odom Gadol. So therefore, he's being praised that not only he himself rose to such a level, but his father was also. When we talk about in connection with the next piece, a couple of pieces further, when we talk about the story of Rebbe's Ptira, we're going to have another example of an enormous Rishon whose father is less well known, but whom we're going to say had a certain mila over most other tzaddikim in history. So yes, sometimes you have. So here we don't know much about Rabbi Shor ben Levi's father, but obviously it was important enough that the announcement mentions him. Mind you, though, I think there are some people who want to say that Rabbi Shor ben Levi's father is the Amora Levi, but it doesn't seem to work out chronologically and for a number of other reasons. Onward, the Gemara says, Rab Chanina bar Papa was his friend. Whose friend? Rashi says it means the Malach HaMavis' friend. So he was on good terms with the Malach HaMavis. On the other hand, On the other hand, there's a different explanation that what it means is actually that it means he was Rabbi Shurban Levi's friend, meaning in other words, he's his equal in Sidkus. They were a couple of generations apart, but then it would mean that he was on a similar level. So, when he was about to pass away, so the Beis Din Shamayla told the Malach HaMavis the same instructions, go do for the Chamin Bar Papa whatever he wants. So the Malach HaMavis came and appeared to him. So Rabbi Chanina bar Papa said, wait, Shavkan Tzlosin Yoimi, wait, let go of me for 30 days, Ad Ned Tamudoi, until I can review over all my learning. The Amri, because we know the Chachamim say, Ashri Mishabola Kanda Talmudu B'yodei. How fortunate is a person who comes to hear to the Olam Ha'emes and his learning is in his hand, meaning that he knows it well because it's fresh in his mind. So that I want that last 30 days to review all of my learning one more time. We find in other places in the Gemara also a similar kind of thing. We find, for example, it says about Rabbi Yehuda the Amora that he generally wouldn't daven, but once every 30 days he would review his learning, and at that time he would daven. The rest of the time it's Todos Seim Nosei, and he's potter from davening. There are other examples of that. I think it's brought about Rabbi Kiva Eger that he would go through the entire Shas once a month as well. What? How is that possible? It means he'd have to sit and learn 80 blot a day. I don't know. I'm not Rabbi Kiva Eger. I have no idea. But yeah. So Shavke, it reminds me, by the way, of something I once read about, the Or Sameach, Rameir Simcha, and the Rogachov were both Rabbonim in the same town in Dvinsk. The Rogachov was the Rav of the Chassidim, and the Or Sameach was the Rav of the Veltish over there. Rav Simcha Koyen, Rameir Simcha Koyen, yeah, the Or Sameach. They got along very well together, and one time they were talking, and they got to talking, and so somebody was talking with the Meshech Chochma, and somebody, the Ursameach, he's known by both names, whatever, but anyway, so they were talking something about the Rogachover, about his colleague in the Rabbans. So he said, you know, I want to tell you something, people make a mistake about the Rogachover. They think that he's a great going, they think that he has an excellent memory. I want to tell you something, says Rav Meir Simcha. He actually has a very poor memory, but the reason why he remembers things is because he's constantly reviewing it. So you can't say, a memory would be, for example, I learned this last week, I learned this last month, I learned this last year, and I still remember it. He just learned it again now, so of course he knows it. Okay, anyway. So sure enough, Shavke, so the Malach HaMavis left him alone. Again, after 30 days, the Malach HaMavis comes and appears in front of Rav Chanina bar Papa again. Amalei, so Rav Chanina bar Papa tries the same thing. Ach vile duchtoi, show me my place in Gan Eden. Amalei lachaya, the Malach HaMavis says, sure. Amalei havli sakinach, he says, give me your knife. Yom mevasas liba urcha, because otherwise you might frighten me on the way. Amalei, so now the Malach HaMavis is already smart, already wise to this trick. Amalei kachabrach bois the mevetli, what are you trying to do the same trick on me that Rabbi Shurban Levi did? So Rabbi Chanina bar Papa says, and if I do, what's the problem? I see Sefer Torah. You know what? Bring a Sefer Torah, v'chazi, and have a look. Is there anything in the entire Torah that I haven't kept? So yes, maybe I am tack on the level to be able to demand that you should give me your knife and I should be able to jump in the Gan Eden alive like Rabbi Shurban Levi did. Amalei, but the Malach HaMavis says to him, there's one thing you're missing. Did you join up together closely with people who had Rastan and learned Torah like Rabbi Shurban Levi did? It's not like he's required to do that. I'll be Torah, obviously, but nevertheless, it's, you know, we see that Rabbi Shurban Levi went the extra mile in that, and therefore he was zeicha to this extra thing that he gets to go into Gan Eden alive. But Rabbi Shurban Chanina bar Papa, the Malach HaMavis, what?
How was the second nafshe for
them? Because it was dangerous. He could catch Rasan, but he was relying on the schus of the Torah. But nevertheless, he was still taking a risk. But he figured that it was worth it. Rav Chanina bar Papa apparently did not think that the risk was worth it, and therefore the Malach HaMavis is telling him that slight difference makes a big difference as far as whether you're going to Gan Eden alive or not. Nevertheless, Rav Chanina bar Papa was such a tremendous tzaddik, ki noch nafshe, when he passed away, ifsik le'amud denura ben yidei la'alma. There was a pillar of fire that separated between him, between the mita on which his body was lying, and everybody else. It was a simon, in other words, like nobody else deserves to approach him. Ugmiri, and we have the Kabbalah. The Lemasika Mudidinura Elohad Bedara or the Train Bedara. We know that such a thing, a pillar of fire like that, appears only to one unique person in a generation or two unique people in a generation. So it has to be therefore that Rav Hanina must have been one of the one or two greatest people in that generation for him to have that kind of thing. Earlier in the Masechta we had also that Rav Shmuel Bar Rav Yitzchok in his time had that also for the Simchas Chosin Mekala that we did. Krav Legabe Rav Laksandri. So Rav Laksandri came over to near the mitzvah, as close as he could get, with the pillar of fire over there, Omar, and he says, Hashem, Asevish V'Kvod Chachamim. We understand this came in your honor, but after all, please do it. Please have the pillar of fire removed, so that for the covered of the Chachamim, so they can come close to you, and they can and it should show that they are Roy Lamed B'Mkutsasa, that they taka deserve to be in the same level as you. Lo yashkach, and he didn't pay attention, and the fire is still there. Rav Alexandri says, "Asevish v'kvod avicha." Then do it for the honor of your father. Meaning, in other words, Marisha says, "Listen, if your father was alive, would it be derech eretz that your father should be on one side of this mechitza of this amud eish, and you would be on the other side? And even if not, even if he's not alive, but still he wouldn't have been necessarily deserving of this when he was alive. We see that such a pillar of fire didn't come for him. So please have the pillar of fire moved out of covered for your father, so it shouldn't look like, in other words, you're so much greater than your father." And still loyashkach. Still, he didn't pay attention. Asevish v'kvod atzmacha. So Rabbi Alexandri says, fine, then do it for your own covered. Pasha, so people can get close and be able to make a hesped for you and bury you. So then, at that point, so istalak. Then the pillar of fire went away. Amar Abaya. So Abaya says, what's the point of this kind of amud ha'esh by a levaya? Is la puki mimandalekim afilo oisachas. It comes to exclude from his company, from being nearby him, anybody who didn't keep even one single letter of the Torah. We just said that Rav Chanina bar Papa had said to Malach HaMavos, you can try me. You'll see there's not a single thing in the Torah that I didn't keep. So Abaya says that's exactly the point. This amud ha'esh that you would have by a levaya of a rare tzaddik like that would show that that if there's anybody who missed out even one single letter of the Torah in keeping it, then he doesn't deserve to be near such a tzaddik. Omelet of Adab Amasna, said of Adab Amasna, says to Abaya, you know what? Then I'll give you an example. La Puki Mimar. Well, then, for example, it would exclude you. Dele Isle Maika Le Igre. You don't have a Maika around your roof. That's violating a mitzvah in the Torah. However, the Gemara says, Veloihi, why he took the opportunity, but Pashtus, I guess you could say, once Abaya pointed out this thing, that a person needs to be careful to fulfill every mitzvah, so that Adabai Masna, but Pashtus, you realize I have an opportunity to tell him Totecha for not doing a mitzvah. However, the Gemara says, Veloihi, it's actually not so. Miyabahava, Abaya did have a mica, or a fence around his roof like he's supposed to, but he shaita who the shadi is zika. It just, at that time, a wind had blown it down. So therefore, Adam Amasna passes by, he doesn't see a mica on the roof, and he jumps to conclusions that Abaya didn't put up one. Then Yoda says, listen, I mean, you know, after all, Rav Adab Amasna still might have been not have been fazed by that. He might well have said to Abaya, okay, well then obviously he didn't build the mica strong enough if a wind could knock it down. Amar Rav Chanina. So Rav Chanina says, now getting back to the whole matter of Rasan, Amar Rav Chanina, mipnei ma en bale Rasan b'bavel. Why is there nobody in Bavel who suffers from this disease of Rasan? Mipnei she'ochen trodin, because in Bavel they eat beets. In modern Hebrew, tered means spinach, but in Gemara terminology, it seems to mean beets. The shoysin sheicha shol hizmi, and they drink beer made with hops that grow on a hizmi plant. A hizmi is a type of thorn bush. When you make beer, you have to put it in hops or some similar kind of thing, which gives the beer some of its flavor. And that's it's a plant. It's a parasitic plant that grows on other plants. And in particular. Rav Chanina is saying, when it grows on a hizmi, then it's very good. When it grows on a hizmi bush, then it's very good for you. And in Bavel, they put that in their beer. Amr Rav Yechanan, in the same vein, Rav Yechanan says, "Mipnei ma'in mitzaroyim b'bavel." Why is there nobody in Bavel who suffers from tzaras? We don't necessarily mean the classic thing of tzaras in the Torah. It could be, like we said before, there's 24 mukesh shrin, and one of them is rasan. The same way tzaras sometimes is a generic term for other kinds of skin diseases. We had before in the Masechta, for example, we had in the story of King Izgur, where we had there was tzaras on the meat that was being served to him. Anyway, so Rabbi Yochanan says, why is there nobody who suffers from that in Babel? Again, because they eat beets and they drink beer. But the third thing is, they bathe in the water of the Pros River, and that helps keep them healthy. The subject of the Masechta is various kinds. It starts out by talking about various kinds of arrangements that a husband might make with his wife before they get married in terms of what kind of rights he will or won't have on her nechassim. And then it goes and talks about, you have a case where a person passed away and he has his wife as owed her ksuba, and he also has the money that he owes to other people. So how we decide who gets first dibs on his estate, basically. So that brings the Gemara into a whole discussion of various details of Dinei Mamonos. Masechta Ksubas, by the way, is often, they have a nickname for Masechta Ksubas, it's called Shas Katan, a miniature Shas, because you really have in it like a little bit of every other part of Gemara. So you have considerable parts of Masechta Ksubas, which even though it's in Seder Nashim, you have considerable large parts of it that are more reminiscent of Seder Nezikin and discuss various aspects of Dinei Mamonos. Anyway, eventually that leads the Gemara to the following story. Ahuda Amalei Nichse L'Truvia. A person had said before he passed away, my nechosim should go to Tuvia. Shochim, chola, and then he passed away, and the Gemara gives a couple of scenarios. The first scenario is where just one individual person named Tuvia shows up, and they say in that case that must be that we have to assume that was the one. Now, what about also Beis Tuvia? What if two people of that name come? Well, then it depends. Shochan v'tamad chacham, if one of them is a neighbor of his and the other one is a tamad chacham koidim. The tamad chacham takes precedence, because then we can assume, Rashi points out, before a person passes away, he wants to be able to do as much, he wants to get as much schusim as possible, just like we had before. We had a couple of days ago about Ma'ukva giving away half his wealth to tzedakah before he passed away. Now, supporting a tamad chacham is a tremendous schus. The Gemara tells us in Brachas and some other places that all the rewards that the Nevi'im all said Nevu'ah about is, among other things, for a person who supports Tamid Chachamim financially. So therefore, we can assume that he meant Tuvia the Tamid Chacham. Similarly, Kodim v'Tamid Chacham, similarly, the two claimants, one's a relative and one's a Tamid Chacham Kodim, then also the Tamid Chacham comes first for the same reason. So, Iboyla, who's Shochan the Kodav Mai. Now, what about if you have the two claimants, neither one is a Tamad Chacham, one is a relative, one is a neighbor, then what do we do? And Maram Shif points out, by the way, that the Gemara may be implying that if one of them is both a neighbor and a Kodav, maybe he takes precedence over the Tamad Chacham, but maybe even not. Anyway, but what if it's one versus the other? Toshma, well, you have a Mai, so what's the din? Toshma, well, we have a Postik and Mishlei, Toy Shochan Kodav Me'och Rochit. A nearby neighbor is better than a distant brother. Meaning, in other words, that in a way, your neighbor who's available to help you all the time is better than even a brother or a close relative who's not always available. So therefore, we can assume, in other words, that he actually meant to give it to the Shochet. What about Shneim Krovim, Shneim from the Chachamim? What if both claimants have are equal as far as these things? Well, then Shuda the Daini. Then at that point, it's the discretion of the Dayanim. Now, Rashi explains the word Shuda means literally to throw or to cast. So it means the Dayanim have to figure between these two people, which one did the mess more likely mean? Yes, you have two people who are both Tamid Chachamim, two people who are both neighbors. Which one, when he was alive, was he closer to? We have to evaluate that, and then we have to figure on that basis which one gets it. Tosfos here and in a number of other places in Shas disagrees with that definition of Shuda Dedaini, and they bring various proofs that it means that it's actually completely up to the discretion of the Dayanim. The Dayanim can decide on whatever basis they want that one of them should get it versus the other. It could even be just like we don't even have to give a reason for it, just we felt like it, and that would be in a case like this. In other cases, if Gemara says Shuda Dedaini, then that's good enough. There is even an interesting explanation from some Rishonim that the word Shuda is actually short for the word Shuchda, which is like you have the word Shoichad in Lashon Kodesh. Often we find that the Ches in words drops out. So they explain that it actually means that one of the Bali Dinim would actually, now Tosfos says over here that it certainly can't mean that the Bali Dinim can pay money to the Dayanim to sway the verdict in their favor. A Dayan is not allowed to accept pay b'chlal. However, there are some Rishonim who say that maybe in this case they could. Since it's up in the air anyhow, and each of them has an equally valid claim, then maybe even in that case one of them could actually give something to the Dayanim to have to sway them in his favor. That's some Rishonim learn that way, yeah. Okay. In the following perek, two perekim later on Monday Zonis Perek Achadaser, talks about basically the perek talks about the dinim of what happens, what rights does an almana have after her husband has passed away. Eventually, she's going to collect her ksuba, but before she collects her ksuba, it may be a while before she wants to collect it. She may be in no put it this way, she may be in no hurry to collect it because then once she does, she's going to be on a fixed income. She's not necessarily going to have, so if she's going to get remarried, for example, she wants the ksuba so she can use it towards the wedding expenses for getting remarried. But otherwise, she may prefer to remain, otherwise she may prefer to be getting, she gets mizonis, she gets support out of the estate. Later on, it talks about that she's entitled to live in the same house that her husband did, etc. So the perek on money mizonis talks about those dinim. So in the middle of the perek, it talks about like this. Now, on the other hand, if they're going to be doing that, if the Yisraelim are going to be supporting her and giving her a place to live, etc., then she has certain responsibilities for them. Udi in the Masechta talked about the responsibilities that a wife has to her husband with various kinds of housework. So the Gemara explains that most of those also the Almana has to do for the Yisraelim. With the exception, the Gemara says, of three things, washing feet and making the bed and pouring a cup of wine for them, those are the kind of intimate things that only a wife should be doing, only for her husband, and not anybody else. So those she doesn't do for the Yisraelim, but all the other ones that are talked about earlier in the Masechta that she does. So now that leads the Gemara into a discussion about, in a similar vein, let's talk about a Talmud serving his Rebbe, that there should be various kinds of menial jobs and various kinds of personal shimush that the Talmud should be doing for his Rebbe. All over Shas, we talk about the concept of shimush tamar hachamim. It's not enough just to learn Torah. It's not just enough to learn the words of Torah from your Rebbe. You have to actually serve him personally, which has a number of advantages. You learn from him midas tovus. You yourself learn to be an honor, because you learn that you're doing all kinds of menial tasks. You learn from him how a Talmud Chacham behaves even outside of the Beis Medrash, etc. There's a number of points in it. So now the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chiya ba'Abba Amar Rav Yechanan, Kol Ameinei Talmidim L'Shamshay, if a person prevents his Talmud from serving him, Kol Ameinei Menu Chesed, then it's as if he's holding back from him Chesed. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Lamos Me'Re'ehu Chesed. Lamos, we understand to be, Rashi says, Lamos is Moloshin Mamis, like melting away. He causes the chesed to melt away by not allowing the other person to have it. What does that have to do with a Talmud and a Rebbe? Rashi points out the previous pasuk, this is a pasuk in Eov, the previous pasuk ends, V'sushia nidcha mimeni. Tushia has been pushed away from me. This is part of one of Eov's speeches. Tushia, the Gemara mentions in a number of places, it was a few days ago in Daf Yomi, me is another name for Torah. So therefore, so we're saying that, so we're talking about Tushia, about Torah, and then we're saying, Lamos Me'Re'ehu Chosed, so therefore that's the implication, is that you're talking about a Rebbe and a Talmud, and the Rebbe is not allowing the Talmud to serve him. So he's taking away Chesed from him, because he's preventing him from learning that, from learning the Yiras Shemayim and all the other good qualities that he would be able to do when he's doing that. Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar, Ach Perek Menu Yiras Shemayim. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says, not only that, he causes the Talmud to lose his Yiras Shemayim. Shenema, the Yiras Shaka Yazav, as that same Pasuk in Eiv continues, and he abandons the fear of Hashem. So in other words, the Rebbe should allow the Talmud to serve him, so that way he's doing a chesed for him, and that way the Talmud has the ability to develop a sense of Yiras Shemayim, which he wouldn't be able to if the Rebbe doesn't allow that. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ula, Tes Zayin Tevis. We were learning yesterday about what the Rebbe said about Kol Yomei Chayecha L'Havi V'Moisa Mashiach. So another sticha on that subject, that everything that a person does, Kol Yomei Chayecha, every detail throughout the day, has to be permeated with L'Havi V'Moisa Mashiach. Now, there are places where they have the Girsa L'Rabbeis Yomoisa, not in this particular Mishnah, but often when we say, often we don't say L'Havi. The expression often is that such and such a word in a pasuk, L'Rabbeis, it comes to include. He was saying L'Havi. So that means that the Shliach himself is standing and waiting that Mashiach will come, and then he'll have a portion in it and have Hanah from it. That would be L'Rabbeis. That would be the mentality of L'Rabbeis. I'm ready for it to happen, and I'm available as soon as it happens. L'Havi means that he's actually doing whatever he can to bring Yemoisa Mashiach. That being the case, then all inyonim and all pa'olis are permeated with inyonim Mashiach. That means also when a person is eating and drinking, he's looking forward, he's yearning for the surah Slav Yasin and the Shur Abar and the Yayin HaMashumar, to the point where even that I've been saying in the Sicha, after the Suda, a person will still feel a sense of hunger that he hasn't yet had the Lav Yasin and the Shur Abar and the Yayin HaMashumar. Hey, continuing on halachas of Shabbos, if you hire a worker, for example, you hire a worker to do a job on Shabbos. Now, obviously, there aren't that many jobs you can have a person do on Shabbos, but even if something that's mutter, for example, to watch him, to watch something, to babysit, let's say, or whatever, the worker is not allowed to take schar Shabbos by itself. But if, for example, you're hiring him for a week or a month at a time, then he's allowed to be paid for Shabbos b'havlah. Meaning, in other words, you're not going to say that I'm paying you X amount per day. You're going to say, for example, I'm paying you X amount per week, and that includes also the work of Shabbos. One example where this comes up is, for example, the Balei Kriya. Strictly speaking, you're not getting paid for the actual laning on Shabbos, because that would be Schar Shabbos. You're getting paid, in principle, for the fact that you're preparing before Shabbos. So, therefore, it's more b'havlah. It's kind of a combination. You're preparing before Shabbos and laning on Shabbos, and it's b'havlah, and therefore there's more of a heter for it. But similar with similar other kinds of things, you'd have to work something out like that. Yeah.